we're talking about urbanization and the built environment and health. And John had wanted to have some diversity here, and because of Larry Frank's presentation on transportation, and we have the director of Smart Growth, Don, is going to be following me. John asked me, rather than present what I really want to present on, which is about bicycling, because I love to bicycle, he asked me if I'd talk about diarrhea and pathogens. So, somebody's got to do it. So, I'm going to be talking about tomorrow in the climate change plenary at 10:30 tomorrow. I'll be unveiling our triple win bike project and the answer of solving obesity and air pollution and climate change all at the same time. But that's for tomorrow. But today, what I'm going to talk about is a little bit about urban sprawl. And this is my hometown, Baltimore, Maryland, in the year 2025. And this is the famous cartoonist from the Baltimore Sun, Cal. Basically, you can see here that the Beltway has expanded to 1,472 lanes. It's a good benefit in that there's only 95 yards between the Baltimore and Washington Beltway. And my favorite one is the New York Beltway up here, formerly the state of New Jersey. So you've heard from Eva about the problem when sunlight energy, you know, hits this black asphalt surface and that retains the heat, and you get the urban heat island effect. And you saw the diagram of the urban core is always warmer than the surrounding area. So the urban heat island is a big issue. She gave a bit of mention of what happens when it rains really hard, and you know, rain hits that impervious surface, you get increases in runoff. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about that issue, not the heat island, but about the runoff and waterborne disease contamination issue. So that's the diarrhea part of it. John also asked me to, even though we're focusing on the urban environment, the built environment, that around the world there are other places where increases in human settlement can actually disturb the natural habitat and affect disease risk. So I'm going to be extending beyond the urban environment for a little bit and talking about that. So, in a nutshell, the first area is the issue of land use and climate change, and the fact that climate is projected to bring us heavier rainfall, like flooding events and heavy rainfall events, and what that means for waterborne disease risk, but also how climate change mitigation, for example, biofuels, may actually affect land use change. So what we do in the urban environment for our changes in fuel use could actually have broad implications for other parts of the world, and I'll show you some links there. So as climatologists are always reminding us, it's not just global warming, it's climate change, because it's extremes of the hydrologic cycle, more floods and more droughts, as well as warmer temperatures and rising sea level. And according to according to Tom Carl of the National Climatic Data Center of NOAA, this is showing a graph that they've put together looking at heavy rainfall events in this country for the last 90 years. So you can see that there are more locations that are experiencing heavy rainfall, more than 2 inches per day, heavier rainfall events. So it's not just drizzling like Tim, where you're from in the out west, but it's really heavy rainfall events. And that has implications for public health, of course. We asked the question, of reported waterborne disease outbreaks in the United States from 1948 to 1994, so that's a pretty long period, of reported waterborne outbreaks, how many were preceded by heavy rainfall events? And what we found was that 2/3, 67% of reported waterborne diseases are preceded by rainfall in the upper 80th percentile. Now, because this is APHA and you guys know how terrible reporting is for waterborne diseases, I'll tell you that the way we did this study was we just compared one location to itself over a 50-year climate period. So if there was an outbreak in a town, we compared the weather around that outbreak to the 50-year weather period, the 50-year record of weather for that related watershed. So we're not comparing place to place. And then we ran Monte Carlo analysis. So we think there's good reason to believe that heavy rainfall is a contributor to contamination. Jan Semenza here has done some studies looking at contamination of beaches and has found also that beach contamination events occur after heavy rainfall. Now, this is a slide of a colleague of mine, Kellogg Schwab, up at Hopkins. And this slide is quite remarkable, I must say, because what you're seeing is Niagara Falls right here. And what you're seeing is over a trillion gallons of sewage and stormwater that overflow every year in this country already. This would keep Niagara Falls running for 18 days. These combined sewage overflow events, they're called CSOs. EPA has, you know, been asking communities, there are over 900 communities that still combine sewage and storm runoff. So they've been asked to clean it up. Well, how many of you are sanitary engineers and know how much it would cost to redesign a urban water system? Maybe tens of billions of dollars? So this problem is still with us. And I think Washington, correct me if I'm wrong, has about 20 to 30 CSOs every year.
It's a big problem now.
So this comes from Baltimore, I hope, right? Anyway, so this is a problem that we have today, combined sewage overflows because of heavy rainfall. And if you take a place, let's ask, what does IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, say for North America? What will the rainfall look like? Well, according to IPCC, you can see that depending on whatever different climate scenario model you use, and of course you use a bunch of them so you can sort of get a range of effects, you know, that basically, you know, by the middle of the century, we're going to be seeing an increase in heavy rainfall events. So if you think about a place like Milwaukee, where they had, you know, 1993, the cryptosporidiosis outbreak that it exposed over 400,000 people, 54 people died. Well, I've been talking to the water managers in Milwaukee, and the pipes are leaking. A lot of infrastructure, a lot of cities have leaking water systems that they're failing. Imagine if you have droughts and heavy rainfall, the pressure differential on these water pipes. People are really concerned that if you have these scenarios of heavier rainfall and drought in between, that it could really cause havoc on the current water infrastructure. Let me shift gears now to talk a little bit about outside of just the urban environment, what about climate, you know, extreme climate, like hurricanes, flooding, heat waves, but I'm not going to talk about heat waves because Eva did. But what about land use change, what we do on the land? How could that affect our vulnerability to extreme climate? And during Hurricane Mitch, I can tell you that where almost 10,000 people died, it was areas with extensive deforestation and degraded hillsides where they had the most mortality and morbidity. So again, as far as risk from climate exposure or extreme climate events, that what we do to the landscape can actually precondition our vulnerability and make us more or less vulnerable. And in the earlier climate presentation this morning, I can't remember who showed the map of New Orleans, but you did. John showed the map of New Orleans. Yeah, right. I knew it was you. Anyway, so New Orleans is between, here's the Mississippi River, and there's Lake Pontchartrain. New Orleans sits right about here. And this is what the wetlands, the coastal wetlands, looked like in 1839. And because we channeled the Mississippi for flood control, we lost the, you know, the silting, you know, the river sort of moved around and built up the wetlands and kept the silt flowing. But now it's all channeled. So look what happens from 1839 to 1870 to 1993 as far as wetlands, coastal wetlands, potentially buffering and protecting that city from Hurricane Katrina. The projection for, I'm a Mac guy, I'm only used to one-sided mice. Okay, so, and this is the projection for 2020 as far as the degradation of the coastal wetlands. So when you're thinking about an urban environment like New Orleans, it's not only, you know, issues of heat island, but it's also issues about what we're doing to the landscape. And by protecting the ecosystem, the ecosystem service of the wetlands there could be to buffer and protect against inevitable hurricanes, whether or not they're related to climate change. Of course, that's the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Well, finally, I want to talk about one other aspect of land use change, and that is that as we have suburban sprawl and we're sprawling out of cities, and we take farmland like this, we chop it up and we put houses on it, or we chop up a forest and make it farmland and then houses come later, we're fragmenting a lot of forest ecosystems. And many of you probably already know the relationship between habitat fragmentation and Lyme disease. This is work. This is where we have the Lyme disease tick. And you probably have heard of this biodiversity and the dilutional effect, that if you chop a forest into pieces, you've got a lot less species that can survive. However, mice can survive anywhere. And so as you chop up a forest and you lose predators, you lose fox and all sorts of different species, you get mouse populations, and the mouse, the white-footed mouse, is the best carrier for Lyme disease bacteria. And so Rick Ostfeld and his colleagues have looked at this issue, and basically, you know, small forest fragments and loss of biodiversity lead to big mouse populations and plenty of intermediate hosts for Lyme disease bacteria and Lyme disease risk. So as far as the urban landscape, of course, you know, suburban sprawl is partly at the root of a lot of these issues, and so we may be increasing our risk of Lyme disease in that way. Now, on my Macintosh, what you would see, it's not that important actually, but on my Macintosh, what you would see is a picture from last month's National Geographic. In the October National Geographic, they had a great feature article on biofuel, growing fuel the wrong way, the right way. It's a great article on biofuels, and if any of you want to know about biofuels, I would recommend getting last month's National Geographic. And why I put this in here is because we're talking about urbanization and alternative transportation. Some cities are switching to biodiesel and ethanol in their vehicle fleets. So if we're talking about biofuels, let's make sure that we do a full health impact assessment. And I say that because Andy Dannenberg is here, and that, you know, health impact assessment, if we're going to be solving this climate change problem and we're switching fuels, biofuels, everyone's jumping to it. But we know that if we are burning food in our combustion engines instead of ourselves, that could be a food security issue. And there's some study, from, I can't remember which organization, is saying that if the price of food, for every percent increase in the price of staple foods, that leads to 16 million more people at risk of becoming food insecure. Now, that's just one number. I don't know if I believe it, but the bottom line is that our food shipment aids and food pricing is very important as far as food availability around the world. So biofuels and malnutrition could be a problem to be aware of. The other issue is that if we do go about using biofuels, it could have a devastating effect on the remaining forest, tropical forest that we have. Already, there are oil palm plantations in Malaysia that are wiping out forests, and they're grown for oil. Soybean production in Brazil, the same thing. So that's a problem for biodiversity, but the way we put what we choose to put in our automobile could also be a direct health threat, because we've done some studies in the Amazon. These are colleagues of mine when I was at Johns Hopkins, looking at the effect of deforestation in the Amazon. And here you can see a settlement. Actually, maybe you can't see. I can see on my computer, but there's a road here, and there's a little settlement in the forest in 1975. And then 10 years later, you can see right here, this white dot, there's more settlement. But look at all these logging roads. And this is called the fishbone pattern. You know, you get these parallel lines, and then perpendicular lines of logging. So why do I show this to you? Well, this is about settlement, land use change affecting this area. And we actually conducted a study sampling mosquitoes and looking at malaria risk along a road that was being built along the Amazon. And if you just focus on the red line, which is the high probability biting rate for the most dangerous malaria-carrying mosquito in the area, Anopheles darlingi, you can see that as you increase forest per grid, per 2 kilometer grid, as you increase forest in that area, the biting rate and the abundance of that dangerous mosquito decreases. So we think that deforestation is a big risk for malaria. So finally, and this is the story here, that development, changes of the habitat, changes in mosquito biodiversity, and higher abundance of that dangerous mosquito leads to malaria risk. So in conclusion, bottom line is that unplanned land use change can modify, for better or worse, the hazardous exposures presented by climate change. And regarding mitigating climate change, and we're thinking about biofuels, many of us are physicians, and all of us are in the health area to some extent. First rule, first do no harm. So if we switch to biofuels, let's make sure we conduct a full health impact assessment, because in fact everything really is connected, and we can't disconnect these problems. They really are all connected. So if you want to get more information and send your colleagues who are school teachers in middle school, and this is a sort of a resource for the general public, a website, ecohealth101.org, there are several chapters. There's the first chapter, Taking Our Temperature, is all about climate change health. The third chapter is all about land use change and health. So you can check out these issues or send these to your friends. And I thank you very much.